Today, chickens coming home to roost. The DFA Daily to the 15th of June 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World Analytics Post, covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Before I start, a quick reminder that tomorrow, Tuesday the 16th of June at 8pm Sydney time, I'll be running my next live stream show, where we'll discuss the latest from our surveys and scenarios. And you can ask a question live via the YouTube chat, or beforehand via the DFA blog. The links are in the comments below. We're getting more reads on the state of the Australian economy. For example, the Australian Banking Association has released an update on loan deferrals to the 12th of June. They said that 772,600 loans have been deferred across Australia, including 480,700 mortgages. And in dollar terms, that's $234.1 billion in terms of loans deferred, including $173.5 billion of mortgages. And that means that around 1 in 14 mortgage holders have had their repayments deferred. Now, Alan Kohler last week in The Australian suggested these deferrals raised a clear and present danger once the six-month grace period is over. If the deferred loans, he says, were treated as impaired this year rather than deferred, and the Big Four's share of them was the same as their 80% share of total loans and advances, probably a safe assumption, impaired loan expenses would be at 16.6% of their loans and advances and would more than wipe out their capital after 6 months. The support program runs out in September, at which point it is assumed $224 billion in loans plus whatever is deferred between now and then would instantly become 90 to 180 days in arrears. And so September is rushing towards the banks. How many of the 744,904 people and businesses and counting will be able to resume repayments? How long can loan deferrals go on for? What proportion of the loans must be classified as impaired at September the 30th, what provisions must be struck for future impairments, how much capital would need to be raised to cover those sums. If it's a 12-month fee amount, that is more than $100 billion, who will supply it? And if the government's various income support packages end in September and October as planned, the bank support will have to begin, or else the pandemic crisis will turn into a financial crisis like no other. Now, of course, at the moment, APRA is protecting the banks by confirming that deferred payments are not sufficient to mark a loan in default. So the question is also, at what point does that exception also run out? Of the big banks, Westpac has the smallest capital buffer in place to absorb a rise in COVID-induced capital losses, Morgan Stanley has observed. According to Richard Wiles, analyst at investment bank Morgan Stanley, the big four banks are likely to increase their credit provisions over the coming months to reflect a sharper than expected deterioration in credit quality in response to the COVID-19 crisis. Mr. Wiles observed that at present, the major banks have collectively set aside about $4.3 billion in COVID-specific provisions, representing around 120% of expected losses. However, Mr. Wiles noted that current provisions are based on credit quality forecasts in March and do not reflect the shift in expectations in recent months. Given we expect credit quality to deteriorate, we'd anticipate the probability of default will increase, which means that expected losses will go higher, which in turn is likely to push up provisions, Mr. Wiles told investors. Credit provisions set aside by the Commonwealth Bank of Australia and Westpac currently represents 140 basis points of risk-weighted assets and 120 basis points for ANZ and NAB. However, Mr. Wiles claimed that Westpac is most vulnerable to a deterioration in credit quality. Westpac has the highest expected loss of the four, he said. That expected loss equates to around 150 basis points of credit risk-weighted assets, whereas the others are all at around 120 basis points. If you consider provisions relative to expected losses, the measures range from coverage of about 140% at CBA to a low of 104% at Westpac, suggesting that CBA has the largest provision buffer on a risk-adjusted basis and Westpac has the smallest. Westpac's impairment charges for the first half of 2020 totaled $2.2 billion, over 70% or $1.6 billion of which related to additional charges associated with the COVID crisis. Of the 480,700 deferred loans, Mr. Wiles is expecting approximately 20% of such borrowers to default on their debt, triggering a $4.3 billion rise in credit losses across the major banks. And this equates to approximately 30 basis points of credit risk-weighted assets, which Mr. Wiles says will require higher provisions. However, the analyst noted that this would depend on the length of deferral periods and the JobKeeper program. Both the deferral periods and the JobKeeper payments are currently set to expire in September. And ANZ has announced that it will now enable home loan customers to switch to interest-only repayments or extend their term for up to 12 months without a full serviceability assessment. The revision, which is effective immediately, follows calls for interest-only loan relief from policymakers after the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, or APRA, issued new guidance around serviceability assessments for borrowers amid the COVID-19 crisis. APRA revealed that while full serviceability assessments would continue to be required for new lending, it would, for the next 6 months, enable lenders to change existing loan terms for up to 12 months without having to conduct a full assessment. However, ANZ has stressed that applicants must still provide a payslip or bank statement no older than 30 days and will be subject to a credit bureau check to confirm eligibility. And ANZ added that eligible applicants must not be requesting any additional credit, must not be receiving other COVID-19 assistance, must be employed and currently receiving income, which can include JobKeeper. Any reductions in income must be temporary and in response to COVID-19, and they must have settled their current loan at least 6 months prior, and they must not be in arrears and must not be paying LMI. ANZ told brokers that the changes would provide borrowers affected by the current crisis with an alternative to repayment deferrals. This process aims to assist customers who wish to proactively manage their cash flow during this period as an alternative to putting their repayments on hold under ANZ's COVID-19 assistance offering, the bank stated. As at the 24th of April, 14% of ANZ's home loan customers paused repayments for up to 6 months, equating to approximately $34.5 billion in loans. ANZ joins Westpac and the CBA in revising its interest-only policy, with NAB the only Big Four bank yet to update its policy to reflect APRA's new guidance. However, NAB had previously told Mortgage Business that while interest-only switches are not available for principal interest borrowers without a full serviceability assessment, it has been fast-tracking interest-only term extensions for eligible customers since April. And APRA released more information about the early withdrawal of superannuation from 177 funds. Funds have submitted that data on a best endeavours basis. Over the period from inception on the 20th of April to the 7th of June, payments made to eligible members have taken an average of 3.3 business days after receipt of the application from the ATO, and 95% have been made within 5 business days. Over the week of the 7th of June, superannuation funds made payments to 167,000 members, bringing the total number of payments to approximately 2 million since inception. And the total value of payments during the week was $1.3 billion, with $14.8 billion paid since inception. And the average payment made over the period since inception is $7,475. Australia has recorded its largest ever decrease in overseas travel, with the number of Australians returning home after a short trip down 98.1% on the same time last year, according to data released today by the ABS. With few Australians leaving the country, these decreases on the back of record falls in March continue to show the effect of travel restrictions put in place by the Australian government in response to COVID-19. The ABS said that 17,000 Australians returned home in April 2020, compared with 916,400 one year earlier. Short-term visitor arrivals also fell to 2,200 trips, a 99.7% decrease from the 700,400 recorded in April 2019. For residents returning home after a short-term trip, there were decreases of more than 97% across all states and territories, but the state with the largest volume of residents returning was New South Wales, with 5,700 trips. However, this was considerably smaller than the 310,700 recorded one year ago. Did you know that DFA runs a Patreon channel as well? And you can subscribe to various tiers, including getting access to our core market data, or indeed mortgage stress data. Just go across and have a look at the different options and sign up. It's as little as $3 a month. The AFR reported that thousands of apartment owners in New South Wales now have a way to launch claims over cladding, waterproofing, and fire safety defects after a new law created a duty of care for builders, consultants, and developers to end users in the construction chain, even without a contractual relationship linking them. The Design and Building Practitioners Bill 2020, which came into effect last week, gives the state's apartment owners the first chance to seek damages for past building defects. It overturned the precedent set by the 2014 High Court decision that found a builder had no long-term responsibility to the occupants of a high-rise apartment building. There are limits to the scope for claims. The law requires negligent actions for defects to be launched within 6 years of a defect becoming known and within 10 years of a building's completion. But this is a game changer for owners of buildings, particularly those with combustible cladding, as it allows them to make a claim even after statutory warranties have run out or where there was no statutory warranty in the first place. Owners of buildings that are part of existing legal actions are unable to make negligence claims under the new law, however. It also has profound implications for the professional indemnity insurance market, as it exposes companies in the building chain, which already struggle to get cover, to a raft of potential new claims based on historical liabilities. But for the buyers of apartments who've traditionally had weaker consumer protection than somebody buying a fridge, it's a big gain. And half the units at a government-owned Kaleen social and affordable rental housing complex remain unoccupied more than a year after construction was completed. The ACT government is in the process of finalising a contract with a community housing provider to manage more than 30 units at the complex. This comes more than 8 months after a call for tenders closed for the site. The Canberra Times understands that a preferred tenderer had been selected by mid-January. There were 66 units built at the site on Baldwin Drive on the block of the former Canberra Bokie Club. Of those, 33 units comprised for public housing units managed by Housing ACT, with the other half to be affordable rental properties managed by a community housing provider. There are four tenants yet to move into the Housing ACT, and the 33 units to be externally managed are vacant. In August last year, the ACT government called for a tender from community housing providers to manage the affordable rental properties. The call for tenders closed in October last year, but a spokeswoman from the ACT Community Services Directorate said the process had not yet been completed. Housing ACT undertook a process to select a community housing provider to manage the 33 affordable rental properties that will target low to middle income households most in need, with a focus on older people, women, and people living with a disability, she said. The outcome of that process will be finalised very soon. Seven community housing organisations submitted tenders, and the government spokeswoman said Housing ACT anticipated a contract with the preferred tenderer be signed within the next 2 weeks. The Canberra Times understands organisations that had applied for the tender but were unsuccessful were informed in a letter on January the 13th, pre-contract negotiations had begun with a preferred tenderer, an outcome would be advised at a later date. The spokeswoman indicated events such as bushfire smoke, the bushfire threat, and the COVID-19 pandemic had held up this process. Housing ACT has been focused on providing and delivering unprecedented levels of intensive support to help people experiencing homelessness, public housing tenants, and community service providers, she said. These conditions have created challenges to ordinary activities like moving house and disrupted government and community services in their ordinary work like providing face-to-face service provision. The spokeswoman said the development built as part of the ACT Public Housing Renewal Programme was handed over from the Builder to Housing Action on March the 20th, 2019. The 33 affordable rental units at the Cullinan site were part of the ACT government's housing plan, where it pledged to offer 151 homes to community housing providers. When the call for tenders was announced, Housing Minister Yvette Berry said, at the time, it was part of the government's commitment to grow the supply of affordable rental housing. Community housing providers play a critical role in the ACT housing market, and the government is committed to growing their capacity locally, she said. Affordable rental properties are rented out at below market rates, and the asking rent is generally determined by a percentage of a household's income. The spokeswoman said all of the Housing ACT properties had been allocated and that modifications were made to some of the government-managed units before the tenants moved in. Following construction as part of Housing ACT's one-on-one client support during the applications process, Housing ACT identified and completed significant modifications to the development for individual tenants, as well as the automation of all entry doors to each block, she said. As at May the 18th, there were almost 2,500 applications for social housing in the territory, 180 were for priority housing, 1,453 were for high needs housing, and 865 were for standard housing. Have you subscribed to DFA? If you haven't, then you're missing out. Do subscribe to the channel and also ring the bell so that you get alerted when we make our daily posts. There's a restructure coming up at real estate group LJ Hooker. The AFR's Street Talk revealed that KPMG had been appointed administrator to a bunch of LJ Hooker entities as part of a process believed to be aimed at cleaning up the group's corporate structure and financial position. Documents filed with ASIC show administrator KPMG took the reins of at least two LJ Hooker entities late last week. Sources said the decision to appoint an administrator would not impact LJ Hooker's core real estate businesses, which would keep trading as usual. KPMG's Ryan Eagle, Philip Quinlan, and Amanda Conyworth were named as administrators to LJ Res and LJ Res Holdings, and the two entities' directors included LJ Hooker chairman and founding family member Leslie Janus Hooker, Group Chief Financial Officer Simon Heathcote, and former Freehills and Macquarie dealmaker Brian Weir. And now over to New Zealand, where there is talk of home price falls. Westpac wrote that after the COVID-19 crisis broke, Westpac forecast that New Zealand house prices would fall 7% over the final 9 months of this year. New Zealand is staring down the barrel of a severe recession, and house prices always fall during recessions, they said. The 7% number was based on past recessions, and they expected house prices to decline less severely than during the global financial crisis, but more severely than the early 1990s or the late 1990s recessions. And it's early days yet, they say, but there was nothing in the May Real Estate Institute data, which was released today, that would cause them to change their forecast. The house price index fell 0.3% in May, using seasonal adjustment. That comes on top of a 0.9% fall in April, meaning prices have down 1.2% so far. Without seasonal adjustments, the index has fallen 2.2% in total, but that partially just reflects the fact that house prices are usually weaker at this time of year. Seasonal adjustment gets around those time of year patterns and tells us what is really going on, they say. Prices have fallen across most regions, but they have actually continued to rise in Northland, Bay of Plenty, Gisborne, Hawke's Bay, Taranaki, and Canterbury. and they think it's only a matter of time before these regions begin to register price declines too. The only possible exception is Canterbury, where prices have been much weaker than the rest of New Zealand for years and are therefore due for a bit of a catch-up. The standout weak region was Otago, where prices have fallen 3.7%. Digging deeper, the weakness is concentrated in the Queensland Lakes District, where prices are already down by more than 6%. That will surprise no one, they say. Queensland Lakes have been much more heavily exposed to international tourism than any other region and faces the weakest economic outlook in the country. So it was always destined for the biggest house price decline. The number of house sales is still only half of what it was a year ago, and this might partially be due to the Level 3 social distancing requirements that prevailed through some of May and made open homes more difficult. But at 3,990, the monthly number of house sales is not much different from what it was during the 2008 recession, and they doubt that the season-adjusted monthly number of house sales will lift very much from here. For two reasons. First, the number of people moving into and out of New Zealand will be extremely low for some time, and this will reduce the fundamental need for house transactions. And second, during recessions, people are less likely to move region, upgrade their house, or invest in property due to fear of what might happen in the economy. And this time will be no different. We do have, they say, to admit that there are a couple of silver linings in the house price outlook. First, it is starting to look like the economic fallout from COVID-19 will be less severe than we had initially expected, they said, thanks to the early move to level one. And second, interest rates are extremely low, and that tends to boost asset prices. Share markets are arguably already reacting to both observations and have generally been rising recently. But while we acknowledge these upside risks, we still think, they say, that our forecast of a 7% house price decline is consistent with the economic outlook and the data so far. And finally, Ian Verinder, ABC's business editor, wrote, "Forget everything you ever learned about the economy and the supposed link with financial markets. Just 3 months into what the Bank of England describes as the deepest and sharpest downturn in centuries, and stock markets are on a tear, galloping back towards record levels at breakneck speed. Investors, many of them new converts to the cargo cult, are overlooking the hit to corporate earnings that has yet to play out, the potential housing market slump and spending blow from a lengthy period of elevated unemployment, or the many geopolitical risks building, particularly between China and the West. Instead, they are pricing in a swift and almost perfect recovery based upon the presumption that maybe, just maybe, there'll be a vaccine that will suddenly rid the world of the pandemic that has created so much pain and hardship in such a brief space of time. Or maybe the whole thing is just an illusion. For when it comes to finance, free markets have become captive to central banks, which are now pouring trillions of dollars into the global economy each month to fabricate a recovery. It's cash that's being created out of thin air, and a huge proportion of it is being poured straight into stock markets, regardless of what is happening out there in the real world. On Thursday night, Jerome Powell, the head of America's central bank, made no bones about where he saw the American economy heading. The dire picture he painted, a future where millions of Americans would never get their jobs back, included predictions that unemployment would be sitting at around 9.3% at the end of this year and 6.5% by the end of next year. The economy would take years to recover, he told them. For anyone who's been following global events, it wasn't exactly a revelation, but it sent shivers through the investment world. His message served as a reality check from the past 2 months of frenzied share trading that has seen American tech stocks regain their record levels and push global stocks into the strongest bull run in history. Wall Street, having erased all its losses for the year, plunged almost 7%. But the pessimism was short-lived. On Friday night, it was back to business as punters regained much of the previous night's lost ground. And here's why. So intense was the economic downturn, which has seen US unemployment go from its best in 50 years to its worst in 90 years in the space of 2 months. Mr. Powell warned that the Fed wasn't thinking about raising rates. "We're not even thinking about raising rates," he added, for good measure. And then he included the magic words, "What we're thinking about is providing support for this economy. It could take some time." And that was the not so subtle message that the money was going to keep on flowing at record pace. And the graph tells the story. In the past few months, America's central bank has brought more than $3 trillion worth of assets. These include US government debt, mortgage debt, and other debt securities, using cash it has generated out of thin air, simultaneously driving interest rates down and flooding the economy with cash. It has spent more than double the amount outlaid at the height of the global financial crisis, and it appears we've only just begun. Once upon a time, the Fed used to see itself as the great moderator. Its role, according to one-time boss William Chesney Martin Jr., back in the 1950s, was to provide enough punch to get the party going and then remove it just when things were warming up. But these days, central banks around the world have found themselves trapped by their own creation. Having gone too far warming up the party, no one really wants the pain associated with the extended hangover. So it's been a policy of hair of the dog for at least the past 20 years. And that's because when stock markets turn south, people lose money and stop spending. When they collapse, as they did in March, they now have the power to take the economy with them. For most of the past half century, central banks have been content to rely upon interest rates to speed up or slow down economic momentum. But with rates now at zero, money printing, or quantitative easing, as it's called in polite circles, is all they have left. Unless, of course, they head into negative interest rate territory, where few are reluctant to venture. We've arrived fairly late at the party, but a few months back, our very own Reserve Bank was forced to do the same. It waded into the financial markets and bought around $50 billion worth of Australian government debt in a bid to massage interest rates lower. Again, it was because Australian interest rates now sit at just 0.25%, as low as the RBA is prepared to go. But it's a paltry amount compared to the trillions outlaid by the US, the UK, Europe, and Japan. Quantitative easing is supposed to lower borrowing costs, thereby boosting profits and investment, and encourage firms to start hiring workers. That's the theory anyway. In reality, it has done little of any of the above. Instead, it's encouraged firms to borrow, but then hand the cash straight back to investors, which has encouraged ordinary savers to abandon relatively safe interest-bearing accounts and invest in stocks that yield a far better return, but which are far riskier. It's also encouraged speculation in housing in a boom that commenced with financial market deregulation in the early 1980s and which barely encountered a hiccup through the global financial crisis, as this Reserve Bank of Australia graph shows. What this huge injection of cash has done is prevent what central banks fear most, the contagion that could spread from what's known as the negative wealth effect. If housing and stocks get slammed, it could cascade into a deep and severe recession. The problem is that central banks created that boom in the first place. Now they're too scared of the repercussions to let those bubbles pop. The biggest side effect, however, is that wealth becomes more concentrated among the already wealthy. And if you own a house or stocks or bonds, you've become rich without even trying. The Fed's response has deepened wealth inequality, says Mohamed Al Eren, chief economic advisor at Allianz. They've produced an incredible recovery in asset prices, and most of these assets are owned by the rich and white segment of the population. all they can say is the alternative would have been worse. Stock markets globally have been on the swiftest rebound in history. If the world's central banks have anything to do with it, that's going to continue, well, at least until some other crisis rattles investor confidence to the core. So a very nice summary there from Mr. Verinder. And I think he's caught it quite well. Central banks are printing money. All that money is flowing into the financial system and financial assets. But it has very little to do with the real economy. And all the data from the real economy is suggesting more pain ahead. But then, there's nothing new there if you've been following this channel. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching. And I'll see you again next time.